from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. As part of a special Forum broadcast from WAMU in Washington, D.C., we're in the nation's capital talking to a panel of journalists about the upcoming transition from President Obama to Donald Trump, including the latest news as the inauguration approaches, with questions swirling around the president-elect's cabinet picks, potential conflicts of interest, the ethics of divesting, Obamacare, and much more. That's all coming up next on Forum, right after this. And welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. And on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we're reporting live from Washington, D.C. at the studios of WAMU. My KQED colleagues and I, in fact, are here all week covering Friday's inauguration, the Women's March on Saturday, and much more. And in this hour of Forum, I'm joined by two journalists who've covered all kinds of political transitions and the issues that go with them. We'll be hearing from Rich Lowry in just a moment. But with me here in the studio, E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist, senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, very familiar to NPR listeners. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Wow. What a 48 hours, huh? Just on Twitter, we had Donald Trump going after John Lewis over his comments that he didn't think Trump was a legitimate president. We've seen now just in the last 24 hours, President-elect Trump going after the CIA director, John Brennan, saying perhaps he's the source of all this quote-unquote fake news. What do you make of it, EJ?
Well, I'm curious what Rich will say later on. I am really petrified in a way I've never been before about what awaits us. You know, I'm a liberal. People who read my column know that. And I have been opposed to presidents who took power. I think with Trump, there's a worry that's quite different than the worry, say, a liberal would have with Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush about, you know, what is exactly his commitment to small-L liberal democratic institutions? How does he regard the office of the presidency? These sweeping attacks on opponents after he's elected. There is some tradition in the country of people trying to bring us together. I remember when Barack Obama was elected, he had this big dinner at George F. Will's house with a whole lot of conservative columnists trying to persuade them that, you know, where they may disagree on things, but they're broadly on the same side.
And I think Bill Clinton did something similar with Bill Safire.
Right. And then, you know, George W. Bush's inaugural address, and I was one of those people who was very upset about what happened in Florida, but that inaugural address that George W. gave was very much a unifying sort of speech. You didn't have this approach to taking over the office. And with John Lewis, you know, who is an icon to so many Americans, myself included, you know, couldn't Trump let anything go? You know, my colleague Mike Gerson, who's a conservative, said, you know, I don't care what John Lewis said about me, I'd still admire him.
And, you know, from a political strategy point of view, it's kind of a head scratcher because, you know, it is MLK weekend, the inauguration coming up. You'd think that Trump, given the numbers that he's showing in the polls, very unpopular for someone who hasn't taken office yet, you'd think he would be reaching out. But instead, he continues to burn bridges.
Right. And, you know, his going after the head of the CIA, Mr. Brennan, now. You know, the way in which any critic, Meryl Streep, can get under his skin is quite remarkable. But substantively, you know, put aside his, you know, his personality, if you will, although that can be very important in a president, you know, substantively, it's very troubling, too. He made an attack on the NATO alliance, or basically expressed deep skepticism about the NATO alliance, which prompted today a reaction from Angela Merkel that was completely, in my view, completely understandable. And you ask yourself the question, are we entering an era when the president of the United States is going to be closer to the leader of Russia, who is fundamentally an autocrat, than our small-d democratic allies in Europe? I mean, you know, Angela Merkel is no liberal. She's a Christian Democrat.
She's
sort of
by
a center
German
right.
Standards. Yeah.
And you know, what is going on here? So again, I wish I could come here and say, well, it won't be as bad as I feared, but nothing Donald Trump has done since the election has reassured those of us who have real doubts about what we're facing.
That's E.J. Dion, columnist for The Washington Post. He's with us for the hour here on Forum. And joining us now, Rich Lowry. He's editor of National Review magazine. Rich, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are you hearing from your Republican friends about not just the past 48 hours, but, you know, where this incoming administration is going, the tone that it's setting, the kinds of messages that it's sending out, the cabinet that it's put together, all these things. What are you hearing?
Well, I think that the general feeling is a cautious, underlined cautious optimism. A lot of things are going to happen legislatively that would have been unimaginable 3 or 4 months ago on Obamacare, on regulations, on taxes. But, you know, there's a big question mark, which is Donald Trump himself and how he'll conduct himself in office. And, you know, I think the address we'll hear on Friday will be like George W. Bush's, quite unifying. But you have kind of the Donald Trump when he's on script written by someone else, and then you have the Donald Trump on Twitter. And there's quite a disconnect there.
And the time between those two things is just breathtakingly short sometimes.
Yes. So I don't think he's going to stop the tweeting. On the one hand, I think people tend to overreact to the tweets, especially the news media. On the other hand, you look at, in the economic arena, he has basically used Twitter to change the calculation of every company in America about whether they want to offshore jobs or not. So it's an incredibly powerful tool. So
is that a good thing? Do you think?
I think economic decisions are not always, you know, black and white. Just adding up the numbers, there is a cultural element to them, and I think it's probably a welcome thing that they think a little bit more about their obligations to the country. And I think there's kind of a carrot and a stick at work. The carrot is the corporate taxes are going to be cut quite substantially, and regulations are going to be pruned back, so it's going to be a better business environment. But the stick is Trump, you know, naming and shaming, and I'm not as comfortable with that, and I think it's prone to abuse. This is a power that has always been latent that every president has, but no one has used it to tank the stock valuation of companies by standing at a press conference or going on Twitter and attacking them.
And by the way, the attack on Boeing, which is one of the biggest employers in the country, doesn't even fit in any way with Trump's economic nationalism. I'm glad Rich introduced that at least slight element of doubt, because if a Democrat were doing this, if Barack Obama did this, every conservative in the country would attack him as an economic dictator trying to dictate private enterprise. And I think that this is a challenge, I think, to conservatives, including people like Rich. And I really admired what the National Review did during this campaign in calling attention to the problems with Donald Trump. National Review had a very strong cover early in the primary campaign about the dangers of Donald Trump and devoted a whole issue to that. And look, Rich and I are going to disagree passionately on stuff like repealing Obamacare, which he's for and I think is an awful idea because it's going to leave a lot of Americans without health insurance. And
although he said to the Washington Post that he's going to go after now Big Pharma. He's going to go after the pharmaceutical companies.
And he said he's going to cover everybody. He sounded like Bernie Sanders for a moment.
Why didn't Obama think of that?
No, right, exactly. You know, so I think it's going to be a real challenge to conservatives like Rich because they may well get the tax cuts and some of the policy and regulatory moves that they want. But there are other aspects of Trump, as I say, particularly in foreign policy, particularly in his attitude toward Putin and ultimately in his attitude toward presidential power. You know, they attack Barack Obama. I think the potential here for Trump to assume power that Obama never would have thought of doing is really high. And so I think it's going to put conservatives in a much more difficult position than it'll put people like me. It's a lot easier for me to speak out on these things. But I think conservatives are going to have a moral obligation, particularly on NATO. Of all things, National Review
was founded on anti-communism, on the alliance against Soviet Union. We don't have the Soviet Union anymore, but we still have the Democratic West.
And Rich Lowry, what do you make and what are you hearing about the concerns out there regarding Mr. Trump's fights with the intelligence community? He was accusing John Brennan, the CIA director, of being the source of the fake news leaks. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, given that how dependent the nation is on the intelligence community.
Yeah, extraordinary and bizarre. And that press conference last week, he, you know, there was this dossier that was published by BuzzFeed that we all know about that was, as far as anyone can tell, most of it, at least the most damning stuff, complete garbage. And news outfits had tried to confirm it, aspects of it, and they couldn't, including BuzzFeed, and they went ahead and published it anyway. Now, if you're Donald Trump, you want to discredit that dossier, and you're fully within your rights to do so. But why pretend that it was produced by intelligence agencies and disseminated by them when it wasn't? You know, it was the product of opposition research produced by a former intelligence officer in Britain. So
and paid for by a wealthy Republican.
Pardon?
And paid for by a wealthy Republican,
right,
reportedly.
Initially, and then the Democrats got in on it after whatever candidate was supporting this, whatever candidate that this person was supporting in the Republican primaries dropped out, and then the Democrats got onto it. But why, you know, it's not factually true, and it doesn't help Trump's case. So he just has this aspect, you know, he calls himself a counterpuncher, and whenever he feels as though he's been slighted or insulted, he will hit back in any way possible. You know, we saw it in the primaries when he accused Ted Cruz's father of potentially being in on the Kennedy assassination. Is that something Donald Trump believed? Is that something that Donald Trump was obsessed with and was going to repeat over and over again? No. As soon as Ted Cruz is no longer annoying him, he never mentioned it again. And that's the way
it operates. Outrage that he said it in the first place. You're right about that. You know, first of all, on that dossier, we don't know if it's garbage or not. It is an unconfirmed dossier, and I suspect a lot of people out there are still going to try to figure out what on that is true or not. But what was especially troubling about what Trump did last week is he not only went after BuzzFeed, and we can debate what they did. I can mount a defense and a critique of what they did myself. But CNN did not publish that dossier. CNN reported something that was absolutely true, which is that both Trump and President Obama were given information showing that these things were floating around, that the Russians had been saying that they had some of this stuff. They were very careful in their report. And Trump started saying this is fake news. It wasn't fake news. It was confirmed news.
Why did no other news organization go with it?
No. On the CNN story, it was ultimately confirmed that yes,
that they had been
briefed.
That's
different from the dossier, which we can argue about. But Trump sort of put them all together and then pushed back. And that confrontation with Jim Acosta of CNN, everybody should watch that. Because I was genuinely, again, I'm going to use the word petrified, to have a president of the United States shut down a reporter who is not an ideologue. Jim Acosta is no ideologue. He was reporting the news. He represented a network that reported the news. This is unacceptable. Reagan didn't do that. Bush didn't do that. Obama didn't do that. They critiqued the media when they felt like it, but not a moment like that.
The Obama White House did try to freeze out Fox News, and there was pushback from other media organizations because that's just really a bad thing to do. And I hope there'll be similar pushback here if this kind of tendency on the part of Trump and his supporters takes a more concrete form than just saying you can't ask a question. But
we never saw Obama, Rich. Go ahead.
Go to executive power also. I mean, and Russia relations, too. It's just partisan hypocrisy is one of the strongest forces in the universe because you had all the Democrats who loved the reset, thought it was a wonderful thing, even though, you know, Putin had invaded Georgia just months before Obama took office. And there's this complete naive outreach to Russia that more or less went on for 8 years with Democrats applauding it every step of the way. And now they're completely appalled that Donald Trump wants to try to redo the reset. You had President Obama explicitly saying, I don't have the power to write immigration legislation on my own if Congress won't pass it. And then when the pressure gets big enough and he gets frustrated enough with Congress not passing an immigration reform bill. He, by executive order, creates a sweeping new immigration system. It's hard to imagine how Donald Trump would possibly violate congressional powers more than President Obama did. But you have the same people who are fine with that, who defended it, who apologized for it, now being scrupulous about separation of powers.
Well, we're probably...
we have a long list of things that argue about. I just want to say one quick thing. Barack Obama never, ever spoke to a journalist the way that Donald Trump spoke to and shut down Jim Acosta at that news conference. That was a step far beyond anything Obama ever did. We can talk about Russia and other things after the break.
Right, we will. And I want to bring in someone else here real quickly. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson is saying that some 99 groups are going to be protesting in the Capitol this week, both at the inauguration and on Saturday. And one of them is joining us now by phone. Linda Capato Jr. is an environmental activist from Oakland and also a member of Disrupt J20, which is the umbrella group organizing some of these protests. Linda, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I just in terms of full transparency, you and I met yesterday at SFO as we were both about to board the plane out here to Washington. But I thank you for joining us. Tell me why you're here. What are you planning to do, and why was it important enough for you to come out?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a call to action a bit ago after Donald Trump was elected president, calling for the shutdown of the inauguration. And so a group called the D.C. Welcoming Committee put together this call to action to protest the inauguration of Trump and his administration and the last year plus time of really disruptive and dangerous rhetoric. And so there will be thousands of folks whose goal is to essentially shut down the inauguration and other events that are surrounding the inauguration.
What does that mean, as you understand it?
Yeah, so I think, so the best way to say it is that we are engaging in direct action, which is, also called civil disobedience and a number of other fun names. But essentially what we'll be doing is multiple groups under various constituencies and issues, so climate, LGBTQ, Black Lives Matter, labor, et cetera, will be engaging in civil disobedience, direct action, putting our bodies in front of the inauguration. And so the hope
is
that
your...
we...
Yeah, go ahead.
We can show folks that Donald Trump does not have a mandate, nor does his rhetoric, nor does his appointees for his cabinet, that we are going to make his presidency as difficult as he plans to make many of our lives.
Is there any concern on the part of organizers, and I realize you're not one of the top-level organizers, but of creating the kind of situation that maybe generates kind of a backlash against liberal groups or sympathy for the president-elect? It is his day to celebrate becoming president.
Of course, and I think this is always an issue that comes up when anyone engages in nonviolent direct action or direct action, and this has been since the beginning of history. Many folks in power and those who support those in power often see this as something that is polarizing. But I think ultimately it has been an incredible resource to communities who often feel powerless to be able to reclaim that power, to be able to say out loud and very clear that they will not stand for these policies. And yeah, I think ultimately if we stood quietly in the streets and held signs, if we signed petitions and just put a long sign out, we would have that critique as well. Direct action gives folks an opportunity to be heard loud and clear.
All right, Linda Capato Jr., thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Stay safe and be good out there. EJ Dionne, we are seeing I don't know if it's unprecedented, but a large negative reaction to Friday's event, to this inauguration. What are your concerns as a liberal Democrat as you hear someone like this one individual protester talk about her plans?
Well, let me just go back to what Rich said, because I just don't want to let it stand in terms of Russia. First of all, I will never disagree with anyone who says both parties are capable of hypocrisy. I believe in original sin and flawed human nature. So, yes, we all engage in some of it sometime. But I think there is a world of difference between the opening to Russia first that George W. Bush had. Remember, he said he looked into Putin's soul and saw that it was good, whatever. To finish that quote properly, somebody out there can do it for me. And the Obama administration, yes, did believe early on, particularly when Mr. Medvedev was president, when Putin technically stepped down, that there was an opening to do some business with Russia. They did the arms treaty.
And that's true. That is demonstrably different in both cases and from the embrace of Putin that Trump has engaged in from the very beginning of his campaign. I don't think Obama's on the record as saying anything approaching what Trump did. And Bush and Obama both strongly supported NATO, and they have never said the kind of things Trump did. So I think conservatives have to be very careful. They can criticize Obama if they want. It's a free country right now. But
right now.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. It is a free country. Trump has really taken this to a very different place, and I think conservatives need to acknowledge it. In terms of political action, there is a broad tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience. I think that we have to point out to everybody that whatever actions we are taking collectively, people on the center left or people farther left than that, that we're doing it in the name of patriotism. And one of my sort of guiding statements was made way back in the 60s by the great American socialist Norman Thomas when people started burning American flags, which I've never liked because I think we're trying to repair our country. We're not against it. Norman Thomas said, wouldn't it be more effective if protesters engaged in the reverent washing of American flags, basically sending the signal, we love this country. We want to preserve its liberty. So I think protesters always need to keep in mind that this is not just about bearing their own witness, but about the kind of signal they send to the rest of the country, whom they are trying to persuade to come to their side.
Rich Lowry, on Russia and its involvement, hacking the DNC and potentially trying to help Donald Trump and all the rest, do you think, how much appetite is there among Republicans in Congress, particularly I'm thinking now of people like Lindsey Graham, John McCain, Senator Richard Burr, who announced that they would be investigating all this? How much appetite is there for a real investigation that, you know, to just see where it leads, and if it leads back to the Trump campaign, so be it?
I think there's a fairly strong appetite. If you actually, in the real world, got close, say General Flynn, I'm just being completely hypothetical here, was closely coordinating with the Russians throughout the campaign, and a congressional investigation began to sniff that out, then it would be you might have some cold feet. But I think there is a desire to investigate this, and it should be investigated. The Russians clearly interfered in our election process, and it's appalling and wrong, and we should be doing what we can to make sure it doesn't happen again. I do think, you know, in what John Lewis said, this is kind of the long process of Democrats working through their stages of grief. Donald Trump is a legitimate president. He won fair and square by the rules that have been set out for a couple of centuries, and I think Democrats are going to have much more success opposing him more as a normal Republican than as a threat to the Republic.
All right. Rich Lowry, stay with us, and E.J. Dionne also for the rest of the hour. And we'd love you to join us, 866-733-6786. The number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org, or send us a message on Facebook or Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, broadcasting today from WAMU in Washington. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny today. We're broadcasting today from WAMU in Washington, D.C. KQED is here all week covering the inaugural events and everything that goes along with it. This hour, my guests, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review magazine, and E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and a frequent commentator on NPR as well on Friday afternoons. If you'd like to join us, we would love to hear from you. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And let's go to Tom in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think it's time for Democrats, and I'm a Democrat, to move on. Donald Trump is the legitimately elected president of the United States, or will be in a few days. And he won fair and square, and frankly, he ran a better campaign than our person did. So I think if this is a teachable moment for our children, what I teach my kids is, look, when you lose, and you will lose in life, You don't blame the ref. You don't say the better man lost, etc. You take your lumps, you move on, and you lose gracefully. And I think Congressman Lewis's statement was out of bounds. Donald Trump is the legitimate president of the United States.
And apart from those comments, because I think we could talk about that for quite a while, what is the role for protest? Where, if you're a Democrat who didn't vote for Donald Trump and you're concerned about whether it's climate change, immigration, healthcare, you name it, what is the role for Democrats? You say move on. I assume you're not saying just roll over and play dead for the next 4 years.
Move on from this ridiculous set of charges that the election was fixed. Cooked. It was, did I say the Russians? No, I meant the FBI. Did I say the FBI? No, I meant fake news. I meant the Ku Klux
Klan. But going forward.
Move on from the election.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tom, thanks very much for the call. EJ, this you mentioned at the very top the 2000 election, which of course was extremely contentious, and yet not as contentious as this one seems to be, largely because I think of the tone of the president-elect. But what how do we heal the country? How do we move on from this election?
Well, I guess I just say I don't entirely agree with the caller in the following sense. First, I've been against the Electoral College for a long time, and I do think it is a problem for the country that twice in the last 16 years we've elected a president who lost the popular vote, in Trump's case by, it looks like, 2.9 million votes. And I think we need to change that system. I've thought that long before Donald Trump ever was in anybody's imagination as a president. Secondly, I do think it matters that the Russians intervened in this election. I do think it matters as well that the FBI put out this report on Hillary Clinton when it didn't have to, when the tradition was not to interfere. And there was a closed hearing last week where Democrats walked out. They couldn't talk about it because of classification limitations. But they were more furious when they walked out than when they went in, because the FBI was aware of some of these charges about Trump and the Russians and said nothing about it. But then sort of levied a charge against Clinton at the end of the campaign when they hadn't even looked at the emails. And when they looked at the emails, there was nothing new there. But Donald Trump ran the last 10 days of his campaign on that FBI business. I think that's important. I don't think we can let that go. In terms of legitimacy, after this campaign, I think Donald Trump has to earn his legitimacy. We do not have a candidate who attacks national heroes from John McCain to John Lewis in the way he did just because they oppose him. We do not have we've not elected a president who called a whole group of Americans rapists, what he said about Mexican Americans early on in his campaign. We have never had a president who talked about women in the way Donald Trump has. I mean, this is, I think it's very important to draw a line between Donald Trump and the normal Republicans. And Rich said earlier that Democrats would be better off to oppose Donald Trump as a normal Republican and not a threat to the Republic. I agree that they will oppose the things he does as a normal Republican. I would be very happy if he turned into a normal Republican tomorrow morning and did not act in a way that does raise genuine alarm among a lot of people I know who are extremely moderate people. These aren't folks who always look to threats to the Republic. These aren't people who, mad as we might have been about Florida, didn't see George W. Bush as a threat to the Republic. I think we're in different territory here.
Rich Lowry, do you think that President Trump can live with James Comey as FBI director? Does he benefit from having him there in some way, or does he need to worry about him being there as an independent head of that agency?
Well, I think they need to consider that Comey has just lost everyone's confidence. And I have I cut Comey some slack because, you know, we talked about how Donald Trump has violated various norms, and he certainly has. But the Democrats violated a very important norm by nominating a presidential candidate under FBI investigation. No one ever would have thought that was a good idea, and it's very likely if you do that, bad things might happen, and they did. And when Loretta
Lynch, she was cleared, she wasn't prosecuted.
EJ,
they decided she hadn't committed a crime.
EJ,
no, go ahead. But
I have great
please,
respect for you, but you're interrupting me, and I wouldn't interrupt you. when Loretta Lynch meets with Bill Clinton, totally inappropriate, on that tarmac before, you know, while this case is ongoing, it casts a pall over the entire investigation, and Comey makes his initial statement when he decides not to recommend an indictment in order to create legitimacy around his decision. Now, I think he can make a very good case he never should have said anything and just stuck by the guidelines. But it's worth remembering the Clinton campaign and Democrats were happy to trumpet things that Donald Trump said at that press conference. And then once he's talked, once he's testified before Congress, once he says it's closed, then he's faced with the decision of, if they're looking at something again and technically opening it again, does he need to tell people or not? And those are just decisions that he's faced with because of Hillary Clinton's misconduct.
But looking ahead, what are the ramifications of having an FBI director that, as you say, has lost the confidence of everyone?
Well, it's not a good thing. And we've talked a lot recent years of losing faith in our institutions, and because of what Comey did, the FBI is another one of those institutions that people have doubts about. Now, you know, a confirmation battle for a new FBI director would be quite something to behold, but it's something we might see.
All right.
The reason I interrupted you, Rich, is only because to say a candidate who's under FBI investigation when the investigation ultimately led to no indictment is a very different thing than an investigation that leads to indictment. Two quick points. One, Bill Clinton should not have met with Loretta Lynch. Everybody agrees on that. That was and I think it hurt Hillary Clinton that he did. Secondly, in terms of Comey, the irony right now, I think, is that however angry liberals and Democrats might be at Comey for what he did, I think the worst outcome might be for Donald Trump to name a director of the FBI, and that at least in Comey's case, and I'm very critical of him on what he did here, we know he has a history of independence, and I would really not be comfortable with Donald Trump having even more influence on the FBI.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Yeah, Rich, quick comment, then we're going to take some calls. Yeah.
I think Democrats have to admit the overwhelming reason that Hillary Clinton lost to the most unpopular candidate than any party has ever nominated, Donald Trump, was that she was a terrible candidate herself and had no message besides Donald Trump is a bad man and unsuitable to the office. And that's just not enough to inspire anyone. It wasn't enough to get her just to win her states that have been Democratic for decades, that if she just held, she would have been the next president.
Nobody believes she was a perfect candidate, but there is enormous evidence that that FBI intervention plus a month's worth of WikiLeaks pushed the election the other way. When you look at 77,000 votes in three states that shifted that election, it is very hard not to conclude that the FBI changed the course of that election.
All right, let's move along now. Let's bring our callers in. And again, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts to forum@kqed.org or send us a message on Facebook or Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Let's go now to Michelle in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm calling to say that I disagree with the comment that Trump is not a threat to the Republic. The conservatives are so excited that they've got the majority in the House and Senate that they're willing to whitewash Trump and what he's been doing. Trump is incredibly masterful at inflaming people's worst passions. He's reactive, over-emotional, and undisciplined. His reactive, inflammatory tweets towards foreign nations has already been causing trouble. And for Republicans to think that they can contain him while they push their agenda through the House and Senate is absolutely foolish and absolutely a threat to the Republic.
Rich Lowry, what are the concerns that Republicans have that you're hearing in terms of his, you know, he is somewhat erratic. He is just the comments that he made to The Washington Post about saying that pharmaceutical companies are now going to have to negotiate for their the drugs they sell to Medicare and Medicaid and perhaps under his Affordable Care Act, whatever that turns out to be as well. What he just sort of, you know, flies in the face of sort of conventional wisdom, and it seems to have worked for him in some ways. But what happens when he starts to be the man in charge?
Well, I put the concerns from where I sit in two buckets. One, ideological, that negotiating drug prices with pharmaceutical companies is something he talked about in the campaign, at least in the primary campaign, fairly often on the stump. It's a policy I don't support, and I think could have all sorts of negative consequences. But kind of the other side of the coin here, though, on Trump's populism and the fact that he's not a conservative, he does bring a certain common sense to some of these discussions. Like the Republican Congress thinks it can just partially repeal Obamacare and then worry about a replacement later. It's Trump who's bringing a more populist voice saying, no, actually, insurance coverage is important and we want to cover people. So I think if you take the Trump sort of top line view on that and actually affect it in policy, the party will be in a much better place than if it wasn't reacting to Trump and if Trump wasn't banging on that. But then there's the other bucket, which the caller was getting at, which is the temperament and the character issues. And these are just profoundly worrisome. And it was a big part of our case against Donald Trump in the primaries. And we continue to have major misgivings about him because of that today. I mean, the difference is that he's going to be president, and we want him to succeed. And it'll be good for the country if he succeeds and he's a good president.
All right. Let's read some of our listener comments here. And thanks for the call, by the way, Michelle. One listener writes, are people in the media talking about different ways to cover Trump? I've read and heard some good advice from a journalism professor in New York and George Lakoff on how to get distracted by tweets to the cast of Hamilton or Meryl Streep and to focus instead on the real important issues at hand. EJ and Rich, it does seem extraordinarily difficult to ignore those tweets, and it ends up setting the agenda. This is what we've been talking about.
Well, I want to get to the tweets, but I think that news conference should send some messages to the media about how they need to proceed. You know, point number one, with Donald Trump, you cannot ask complicated two-part, three-part questions because he is going to try to evade a series of questions. All presidents do some evasion. I'll acknowledge that up front. But Trump, in particular, there are a lot of questions he doesn't want to answer. Journalists are going to have to be very disciplined in how, if they ever get another briefing again, they're going to have to be very disciplined in how they ask him questions. Secondly, there's going to have to be real solidarity in the sense of standing up for the basic right of journalists to ask tough questions to a president. And they can't let a president of any party just shut down another reporter and attack another reporter the way Trump did to Jim Acosta of CNN. And they're going to have to say, well, I want Jim to ask the question, or I'm going to follow up on somebody else's question. So I think there are all of these things that have to happen. And I think in terms of tweets, it's complicated because this is his major means of communication. Some of the tweets are genuinely outrageous. Even some of the tweets that aren't outrageous are genuinely newsworthy. And I think it's going to be a case-by-case issue of where is Donald Trump tossing something out there to distract attention from the big story, and you can't take your eyes off the big story, and where is the tweet so important that you really have to make it a centerpiece? I think the interesting thing about the John Lewis controversy is, you know, many of us are very disturbed by his attack on John Lewis, but we have to go back to what John Lewis said, which was a focus on the Russians, and we cannot lose track of the fact that one of the biggest stories now, which the Senate Intelligence Committee decided to investigate, is exactly what are the links between Donald Trump and the Russians? How deep do they go? We got to figure that out.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Scott in San Francisco, welcome. You're on Forum.
Thanks. Good morning. Good morning. I want to bring it back to a more introspective note. One of the interviews recently that stuck with me was an interview that Jon Stewart had on CBS This Morning not too long ago. And he said that, you know, this idea of political hypocrisy is definitely existing on both sides, where you have guys like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell for conservatives who are supposedly, you know, they tell us that government doesn't work, but then can act as the obstacle by which government will not work, and in some ways force the kind of hand where Obama feels the need to go forward with controversial executive orders. And then on the other side, you've got Democrats who, once Trump gets elected, paint the entire Trump voting bloc as a monolith of being deplorables and racists. And I'm just wondering, what does it take for all of us to kind of come together? You know, if we can't come together on whether or not, you know, these FBI investigations need to go forward, whether or not, you know, Trump is going to be the president that we want him to be, can we at least come together on the notion that, look, we're all kind of putting forward a hypocrisy that is probably no good for anyone?
Well, and Rich, you know, it seems that there are ample ways to unify folks. I mean, there are many ways, starting with today, Martin Luther King Day. There was a report that President-elect Trump was going to go to the African-American Museum and canceled at the last minute. I mean, just putting salt in the wounds of the weekend. You know, so it seems like there are ways to build some consensus, but we just haven't seen it.
Yeah, you know, I think the irony with Trump all along has been a populist working class economics has a chance to appeal to black and Latino voters in a way Republicans haven't in a very long time. You look at that carrier plant that Trump,
the company
quote,
in
unquote,
Indiana
saved. Yeah, you know, a huge percentage of those workers there are minorities, and we tend to be obsessed with the white working class, and that's the phrase we all use for the working class. But there are many, many black working class voters and Latino working class voters, and especially among those working class men. I think Trump has potential appeal, but that's why I would counsel him to avoid kind of radioactive fights with the likes of John Lewis. Let the surrogates do it. Let the surrogates duke it out. But you have the strange phenomenon where usually it's the principal who's above the fray, and it's the surrogates who are much tougher than the principal. In this case, and many others, you have Trump, who's much harsher than the surrogates, who go, you know, Pence and Reince go on TV, and they're, oh, we really respect John Lewis, but we disagree with his opinion, whereas Trump doesn't have any of that kind of grace note in his tweet. And in general, though, just on opposition and unity, it pays for opposition parties to oppose. And Democrats are perfectly within their rights to, obviously, to do everything they can to oppose every inch of the Republican agenda. And I just think, when I made the reference earlier to treating Trump as a normal Republican, I think the things that really bite against him at the end of the day aren't that he's a tool of the Russians or Comey elected him or all this kind of backwards-looking obsession with the election not being legitimate. It's going to be he's throwing people off of health insurance. He's cutting taxes for the rich. This regulation is allowing a company to, you know, pollute where it wouldn't be able to before. It's going to be those kind of criticisms, which are very traditional, which you've heard a lot before, that I think if Democrats really get traction against Trump, those are going to bite. And just one last point, you know, Trump hasn't had a great honeymoon period here. You know, his ratings went up a little bit, but we had a poll last week or so that had him at 37% approval, which is really unheard of for a newly elected president. And it's because he, you know, won despite his unpopularity, which is a very strange thing to have happen. But usually you're a president, incoming president, you start doing things legislatively, you're spending political capital, you're not accruing it. So if he's kind of at a low ebb now, there's a chance he could be lower in a year.
All right, EJ?
I just first want to salute Rich for pointing out that the working class includes African-Americans and Latinos as well as whites, and there is a distortion in the way we are talking about this. Secondly, I think we ought to be very careful with Trump's claims on these jobs, and that these men, a lot of this tweeting is going to be purely symbolic. And in many cases, he will announce jobs staying in the states, that we're going to stay in the states anyway. And all the companies will go along with that because they're hoping for regulatory relief in some other area. But I want to address the point of the caller, which is I am not one of those people who thinks all the people who voted for Donald Trump are delusional bigots or anything like that. I wrote a piece, very long piece for The Washington Post before the election, where back when Trump was way behind in the polls, under the headline, "Even if Trump loses big, the anger will remain. Here's how the left can address it." And I think there are very legitimate grievances that voters who back Donald Trump have about their lives. That we have not dealt with well as a country. Globalization has had complicated and, in many cases, negative effects on people's lives. Technological change has had a negative effect. There are a lot of people out there, both in inner cities and in some of those predominantly white towns that voted for Trump, who have economic grievances that we must deal with. So I do not write off all of Trump's folks as in one particular basket.
All right, let's go back to the phones. George, welcome.
Hi there.
Hey.
I'm, you know, a vet, and I'd just like to say that the gentleman from the New Republic, that the way he characterized Mrs. Clinton as, you know, being under indictment by the FBI and a lousy candidate, et cetera, where Donald Trump is the most unqualified candidate, Republican or Democrat, that's ever run for the office of the presidency. And also, you need to keep in mind that almost 3 million people more voted for Mrs. Clinton than they did for Mr. Trump. And that in any other democracy in the Western world, she would be our president. We wouldn't be having this discussion about this unqualified man that's going to be our new president.
All right, George, thanks for the call. And I just want to thank, I think, Rich, you did not say that she was under indictment. You said she was under investigation by the FBI.
And also, Rich is from the National Review and not the New Republic. The same both.
Thanks, guys, for defending my honor.
I agree with the caller, so I'll let Rich reply.
You don't have to. Let's go back to the phones. We're getting short on time. And Isaac in Oakland, you're next. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say that I think the Democratic Party will be doing itself a disservice if they get too focused on the Comey investigation and blaming the FBI for Hillary Clinton's loss, because it seems to me that they have some serious work to do in order to win back some of these working class voters that are so delusioned with their situation in life and needed something better to vote for than Hillary. So I think the mainstream Democrats need to do a better job of thinking about how they can win new voters instead of focusing on why the FBI lost the election for us or Russia
right,
lost
Isaac,
the election for us.
I'll use the obvious cliche, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think.
And you are chewing
FBI,
gum,
I'm a Nicorette gum addict, I admit it. You can sort of say that the FBI should be held accountable. We should understand what happened there. But yes, the Democrats have to regain ground that they lost in significant parts of the country. And I think that is a debate they will have and should have.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Isaac. Here's some comments from listeners. Terry writes, Trump never called all Mexicans rapists or criminals. He simply said there are immigrants here illegally and we have to do something. That's not quite right. He did say that the ones coming over illegally were rapists and murderers and the rest. But she goes on, I'm so sick of the media misconstruing what he's trying to say. We finally have someone in a political position that wants to tell us what's actually going on in our government. And that's why the establishment is tripping out right now. And that is, Rich, respond to that, if you would. The notion that so many voters who supported Trump just liked that he, quote unquote, told it like it was, even if they didn't agree with what he had to say. And that is very unsettling for a lot of people. But he speaks what's on a lot of people's minds.
Right. And that comment from the listener really encapsulates the appeal Trump has for his supporters. And you know, during the primaries, every time he did something, said something completely outrageous, people thought it was the end of him, when it was really enhancing his brand for his supporters, who really want the system blown up, who think that political correctness has created these overly constrictive rules about what you can say or think. And Trump really appealed to those people on that basis. Again, what I would worry about is, you know, he's president now. He needs to kind of widen out and I would think change his MO a little bit, but it looks like it's not going to happen.
We're getting to the end of the hour, but I want to ask you, both of you, but EJ, you're right in front of me. I'll ask you first. This notion of the resistance, people who are talking about trying to stop Donald Trump at every front, and California, as the largest state in the country, is lining itself up, and it's even hired Eric Holder, the former attorney general, to help California make legal arguments against things and to defend the state's policies on climate change and so on, immigration, health care. What are your thoughts about that, having a state like California sort of lead the charge with Jerry Brown at the front of the line?
I think that there are two baskets that we have to worry about, to sort of pick up on Rich's metaphor. There are policy areas where a lot of Americans, liberals and moderates, will oppose Trump, and they're going to fight those fights. And I think that, you know, and every states are entitled to this. They sure as heck did it against President Obama.
And there are a lot of people who believe there are other ways of opposing these policies, and if only to dramatize what's wrong with them. And then there are the areas where one is genuinely alarmed about civil liberties or an issue that crosses policy and rights, which is the rights of immigrants in the United States. And I think this is where states can play a very important role in vindicating people's rights. And, you know, the Republicans are the party of states' rights or conservatives. Historically, progressives have been quite pragmatic. They've used the states where they could. And there are some areas like Social Security where they think only the federal government can do it. And I think there's nothing wrong with the pragmatic use of state power to advance progressive goals.
Rich, you said earlier in the hour you expected a sort of, I think, traditional inaugural address from President Trump written by somebody else. But what would you like him to say? What do you want to hear from him on Friday? And just quickly, if you would.
Well, an emphasis on the workers of America of all colors and creed, and on emphasis on getting the economy growing again and growing in such a way that the wages further down the income scale are sustainably increasing.
All right. Thanks very much, Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review magazine, and E.J. Dionne from The Washington Post. Thank you, gentlemen. Happy
Great
Martin
to be
Luther
with
King
you
Day.
Both. Thank you.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton, with help today from Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, along with Timothy Olmsted here at WAMU. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We got online support from Amanda Fott. Our interns, Brandon Yu, Maxine Schofer-Wolf, Dan Zoll, our senior editor, our executive producer, Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.